principal founder of organized socialism in Russia, Georgi Valentinovich Plekhanov, was born 100 years ago near the city of Tambov in central Russia. His father was a prosperous country gentleman, and he received the normal education of young men of his class, first at a military academy for the sons of the gentry, then at the Mining Institute in St. Petersburg. The 70s marked the highest point of social idealism among the Russian gentry. Young men of good birth, consumed with a sense of personal guilt and responsibility for the ignorance, misery, backwardness, and lack of elementary justice in which the great mass of the peasants of Russia were living, gave up their position and their prospects, and went in great numbers to the villages, some as doctors, schoolmasters, agricultural experts, even farm laborers, other more resolute spirits, to rouse the peasants by direct propaganda to indignation and ultimately to an armed rising. This generous and passionate mood, with its promise of danger, secrecy, and self-sacrifice in a great human cause, reached its highest peak in the universities and schools. There is a story that Plekhanov, then a schoolboy of 16, forced his widowed mother to sell land to her peasants at a price lower than that offered by a neighboring landowner, threatening that if she refused, he'd set the landowner's ricks on fire and then give himself up publicly to the police. At the Mining Institute, he joined a revolutionary group of students, and in 1876, after delivering a fiery address before an illegal demonstration of students and workers in Kazan Square in St. Petersburg, was forced to escape abroad to avoid arrest. The die was cast. His life was henceforth dedicated to the cause of the Russian Revolution. Like other young men of his time, he was, in the middle 70s, a populist. That is to say, he believed, the populists believed, that the Tsarist regime was corrupt, stupid, and oppressive beyond the hope of reform, and that only a violent upheaval could possibly bring justice and freedom. The enemy was the state. In the 70s, the populist program seemed to be impracticable in Russia, only because he thought that it was still a largely pre-industrial country, and he therefore saw no reason why it must inevitably go through the industrial phase. In the 80s, he abandoned this view. Under the influence of the writings of Marx and Engels, and of his own analysis of what was occurring in Russian economic life, he changed his views. He now believed, and believed for the rest of his life, that although Russian development was retarded compared with that of the West, it would necessarily follow the same inexorable stages, that is, towards increasing industrialization. He now believed that history was a science whose laws could be discovered, that these laws were laws of the development of man's productive resources. Unless men understood what these laws were, they would fall foul of them in the end, and all their efforts to improve their lot would remain frustrated and indeed self-destructive. In short, Plekhanov had become a Marxist. Whereas in the 70s he had believed that laws existed, but that the laws followed by the Russian and social and economic development were peculiar and sui generis, by the early 80s he had convinced himself that they were not, that the Russian village economy was in fact dissolving. The possibility of preserving the village commune, in which the populace had placed all their faith, was a mere dream. What the peasants desired was not communal, but private ownership. In other words, to become capitalists themselves. A capitalistic phase in Russia wasn't avoidable, although it might be shortened and indeed continuously sabotaged by the creation, on the admired German model, of a great social democratic party founded on the support of the growing masses of industrial workers in the big cities. They, the industrial workers, alone would free Russia. Yet, he added, if socialism were imposed by force, it would lead to a political deformation like that of the Chinese or Peruvian empires, simply a renewed Tsarist despotism with a communist lining. The revolution must be democratic, or it wouldn't be a true revolution. Therefore, the key lay in tactics based on scientific training and a program of the widest possible education. But before a revolutionary can educate others, he must educate himself. Plekhanov set to work. Forced into exile, living in penury in Switzerland, he made himself the foremost Marxist scholar of his time. Within 10 years, he became the leading authority, and that not only among Russian Marxists, on the civilization and social history of Russia, on the theoretical foundations of Marxism, on the ideas of the Western precursors of socialism, but first and foremost on the European civilization and philosophy of the 18th century. Plekhanov understood the methods and ideals of the writers of the 18th century, particularly in France, as nobody understood or mastered them before him. They were, of all schools of thought, far and away the most sympathetic to him. The devoted effort of the French philosophes to reduce all problems to scientific terms, their belief in reason, observation, experiment, their clear formulation of central principles and the application of them to concrete historical situations, their war against clericalism, obscurantism, and irrationalism, their search for the truth, sometimes narrow and pedestrian, but always fearless, always confident, and fanatically honest, the lucid and often beautiful prose in which the best French intellectuals express themselves, all this Plekhanov admired and greatly delighted in. Civilized, sensitive, and fastidious, he towered head and shoulders above his Russian fellow socialists as a human being, as a scholar, as a writer. His style is direct, limpid, rapid, and ironical. The knowledge is vast, exact, and lightly carried. The reasoning is clear and forceful, and the final deadly blows against opponents are delivered with an impeccable elegance and precision. Plekhanov, more or less single-handedly, educated an entire generation of Russian Marxists and left-wing intellectuals, as indeed Lenin in later years handsomely admitted. It is idle to pretend that the opera dicta on art or history or literature of Lenin or Stalin, or even of better educated men like Engels or Trotsky or Bukharin, are of much intrinsic value. They interest us only because the men who uttered them are interesting to us on other grounds. But Plekhanov's essays are remarkable intellectual achievements in themselves. His studies of French materialism, of the early socialists, of Russian social history, of Russian novelists, of the relationship of social conditions and artistic activity are always first-hand, always of the purest water, and have transformed the history of these subjects, not least by the opposition, often legitimate enough, which his unbending Marxist orthodoxy has often provoked. Naturally, this distinction, not merely of manner, but of personality, was occasionally found irksome by his fellow revolutionaries. They complained of his aloofness, his buttoned-up, disdainful manner, his professorial airs, his impatience, his mordant irony in dealing with unusually ignorant or uncouth members of the party. And it must be admitted, he didn't suffer fools gladly. Both intellectually and personally, he dominated his milieu. Brilliant, contemptuous, self-critical, touchy, liable to constant discouragement, often ill, always poor, forced to struggle for daily existence in a cause which he held dear, he infuriated only the pretentious, the vain, the confused, the woolly-headed and sentimental. It wasn't altogether surprising that he himself couldn't stomach Lenin, in whom he had early detected an almost monomaniacal lust for power, and indeed also a total lack of scruple. But he detested Trotsky far more. Trotsky's admirers believe that this was caused by jealousy. I know of no evidence for this. A simpler explanation seems to me to be that Trotsky, man of genius as he certainly was, unfortunately possessed no likable characteristics at all. Presently, in 1903, there came the great doctrinal break. Lenin believed in the organization of the Russian revolutionary social democrats by an elite of dedicated professional revolutionaries, against whose decisions the court, whatever they might order, for reasons of discipline, be no appeal. Plekhanov had no more faith in the untutored masses than Lenin himself, and like him, believed in efficiency, order, and discipline. He believed also that everything must yield to the needs of the revolution. But he never tired of quoting Engels' thesis that nothing would be more tragic for revolutionary socialists than to find themselves in power prematurely, that is, before the majority of the proletariat had become conscious of their historic role, or, worse still, before the proletariat had become the majority of the population. After the Bolsheviks broke off from the Mensheviks, Plekhanov came slowly to realize that what Lenin contemplated without qualms was precisely this kind of premature seizure of power, not by the majority of the oppressed, but on their behalf, by a self-appointed group of conspirators. An irresponsible putsch of the kind advocated by such violent social incendiaries as Bakunin or Blanqui, a suppression of the interests of the working class and that of democracy by a handful of demagogues. Indeed, As early as 1905, he declared that the ultimate goal of Lenin's tactics was obviously his own personal dictatorship. And yet, he began by supporting Lenin, because he stood for activism in organization, because he was exceptionally dedicated, tough-minded, and ruthless. He only became opposed to him when he had finally convinced himself, that is to say by about 1911, that the Bolshevik leaders were not merely power seekers, but brutally cynical about means and recklessly and exultantly dishonest in their tactics and with a conception of democracy which turned it into its opposite. He condemned the abortive Moscow Rising, organized by the Bolsheviks in 1905, as a criminally premature resort to arms. A far greater crisis arose in his life in 1914, when international socialism broke over the issue of participation in the war. The Bolsheviks under Lenin and the left wing of the Mensheviks under Martov declared that the war was simply a fight between two rival imperialisms in which the working class had no stake. They therefore boycotted the war and called on all socialists to do likewise. Plekhanov thought this suicidal folly. He argued that the triumph of Prussian and Austrian militarism was incomparably more dangerous to socialism and to the Russian proletarian revolution in particular than the victory of the Western democracies engaged in self-defense. Whereupon he was duly branded with great indignation by his opponents as a traitor to international socialism. In 1917, after the February Revolution, Plekhanov at last returned to his native country to a great but very short-lived triumph. In wartime Petrograd, he gave critical but fervent support to Kerensky and the provisional government, and engaged in a long and bitter duel with Lenin, whom he accused of conspiring to foist the yoke of the tiny Bolshevik party upon the necks of the Russian people, thereby sinning against Marxist democracy, provoking civil war, and with it the danger of a counter-revolution. And was, of course, duly denounced by the Bolsheviks and their fellow travelers as a compromiser, a reactionary, a chauvinist, a Westerner totally out of contact with the Russian masses, a bourgeois traitor to the working class. Plekhanov argued that socialism could be established in Russia by the votes of the majority, that is, democratically, only in conditions of an expanding economy, requiring some degree of collaboration with other left-wing parties, and as a prerequisite, the defeat of German autocracy. He was a great and revered figure, but scarcely anyone listened to him. The words were too moderate, the accent too civilized. The October Revolution had cast its shadow long before. When finally it came, he denounced it with all the biting eloquence at his command. His chronic consumption grew worse in the cold and hungry capital of 1917, and he took to his bed. He expected to be arrested or perhaps even assassinated. And indeed, on the second day of the revolution, a party of soldiers and sailors burst into his bedroom, ransacked his papers, threatened to kill him, and finally wandered off with vague insults into the night. Someone complained to Lenin. He seemed genuinely shocked. Plekhanov was the greatest figure in Russian socialism, and the dictator himself recognized a deeper debt to him, both intellectually and politically, than to any other living man. An order was issued that the person and property of citizen Plekhanov was to be protected in the future. But he was very ill and died on the 30th of May, 1918, in a sanatorium in Finland, to the very end denouncing Lenin's betrayal of all they had both fought for, and in particular his untraining of violence and hooliganism in the land. In the last article by him to be published in Russia, he sardonically recalled that the leader of the Austrian socialists, Viktor Adler, used to say to him reproachfully, "Lenin is your child," and that he used to answer, "but not a legitimate one." The dethroning of Stalin has led to some patronizing praise of Plekhanov as, on the whole, the most formidable enemy of the cult of personality. His writings are again cautiously discussed, not least those which must have acquired a new and exceedingly poignant meaning in this particular day and hour. For events have borne out his gloomiest prophecies on a scale undreamt of, even on the dark and rain-swept day on which his body was carried to its grave.